This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for June 2013. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we usually feature readings from poets in the current issue.
But we're breaking format this month because the June issue is not quite like anything we've done before. It's entirely given over to poetry from Afghanistan.
A very specific type of women's poetry called the Landai. Our guide to the issue, the Landai and Afghanistan more generally, is Eliza Griswold, a poet and journalist who's reported from some of the most troubled places in the world. She joins us from her home in New York, where she recently gave birth to her first child. Congratulations, Eliza.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Seamus Murphy, a photographer who collaborated with Eliza and whose photographs from Afghanistan are included in the issue. Seamus Murphy also made a short film about it called Snake. Seamus joins us today from London. Hi, Seamus.
Hi there.
Before we talk about Landai's, let me just read the one that you begin your introduction with, Eliza, this very beautiful one. I call your stone, one day you look and find I'm gone. Who wrote that little poem?
Well, no one wrote it. That's the beauty of these poems. They are collective and anonymous. They're folk poetry. So they're really passed orally and have been passed over thousands of years between women primarily, Pashtun women, between Afghanistan and Pakistan. So this poem was repeated by a young woman named Zarmina, and Zarmina ended up setting herself on fire. Seamus and I understood that she had done this because she wasn't allowed to write poems. And we traveled to Afghanistan to investigate her life story. And when we did that, we found that not only was she not allowed to write poems, but she wasn't allowed to write them because, as most poems, they were about love. And she had fallen in love with a man, and her family had forbidden her from marrying her cousin. And so that ultimately, along with poetry, led to her death.
Now, once you got interested in this, how did you guys go about finding, collecting, and recording these poems?
Seamus brought my attention to these Landai really probably many years ago, and he loved them. And he loved this collection that had been generated in the 70s and 80s by a famous Afghan intellectual and poet who was very much a dude and who had actually ended up being assassinated by precursors to the Taliban. So there was this wonderful collection out there that really reflected Afghanistan during the Civil War and before. But there was this opportunity to go back and to use these poems as a way to look at the impact of war on culture and to look at the process of U.S. involvement. Because as we found when we started, the Landai have words in them. I mean, they have words like Facebook and internet, but much more telling for the international community, they have drone strikes. They have tanks. They have IEDs. They have all kinds of the language of war spoken not by men on the battlefield, but by women who have lost children, who have lost husbands, who are enraged at the state of their country and their lives. And so the poetry allowed us a window into this world. At the same time, I mean, Seamus's photographs really are poems. They are darkly funny. They capture moments no one gets to see. And this vast archive of these very quiet and telling moments is the perfect match for these words, because they're words and photos and ideas that you wouldn't necessarily come across in headlines about Afghanistan.
Well, let's hear another Landai, first in Pashto, then in English. This is audio from the film you two made.
خال بدیار لوینو کې دم چشین کې باغ کې ګل ګلاب و شرموینه
I'll make a tattoo from my lover's blood that will shame every rose in the green garden.
Tell us about this poem.
So this poem is one of the very most classic Landai. So we're talking about an audience of tens of millions of people, right, who repeat this. And this dates back to the 19th century. The story is that this was first uttered by a famous Pashtun woman who was also a warrior, because traditionally women, and particular Pashtun women, are extraordinarily fierce and fight alongside men in battle. So our perception of a woman, as we say, sort of a mute ghost beneath a blue burqa, that is really not traditionally how Pashtun women viewed themselves or were viewed. And underneath the burqa, the voices are still extraordinarily fierce, as you hear in this Landai. So this was apparently uttered by a woman named Malalai, who was a woman and a warrior poet in the 19th century. She fought alongside her fellow Afghans to cast off the yoke of British occupation at a famous battle called the Battle of Maiwand. And what you hear in this Landai are really all the themes. There are five themes that underscore most of these folk poems: war, separation, love, homeland, this fierce love and longing for homeland, which is called Watan in Pashto, and grief, gham, suffering. And Malalai here is talking about tattoos that traditionally Pashtun women wore on their faces, really a kind of a folk tattoo, a marking, which it would be tattooed to ward off the evil eye when a little girl baby was born. And those are called khal, and they have fallen out of favor now. But so this one we love in particular, not only because it's seen as one of the early ones and actually has a date because it is talking about a specific battle, but also because it reflects all of the themes that are still relevant to Landai today.
I'll make a tattoo from my lover's blood that will shame every rose in the green garden.
Seamus, I wonder if you could talk just a bit about the photographs that you took. We used photographs in the entire issue from various trips that you've taken to Afghanistan. I wonder if focusing particularly on poetry changed the way you thought about these photographs, or if you took them differently in this trip, or how you and Eliza worked together.
Actually, the images from these last two trips, which are dedicated to the poetry, probably weren't that different to the photographs I would normally take in Afghanistan. I mean, the approach I normally take anyway is I follow what's interesting and just go with that. Obviously, if there's a particular brief, I'll try and follow it. But my instinct is always just to go with, you know, what's happening in front of me and let that lead me wherever. And in Afghanistan, even if it's in a war situation, a conflict situation, something with a lot of suffering, there's still a lot of poetry. It seems to exist in Afghanistan in very, very ordinary, everyday places. The people themselves love poetry. Their attitude towards each other is very delicate. And, you know, I always try and capture that in my pictures. So I was able to actually draw on work from 10, 12 trips that I'd made before these two, from 94 onwards. And I found amazing amount of pictures that would suit, you know, the material that was being covered in the issue, because life doesn't change that much for the Afghans. And what I was seeing on this last trip, whether it was in Kabul or whether it was in Helmand, it's kind of similar. It's struggle, it's family, and it's dealing with often forces that are beyond their power. Obviously, the situation of photographing women is something else. And right from the start, I knew that that was going to be difficult and something that in many ways I shouldn't try, because it's not the right thing to do. It could put people at risk. And actually, Landais are anonymous. So it would be against that spirit of anonymity to personalize, you know, do portraits. It's such a different culture to our own that I think trying to portray what they are talking about rather than they themselves was the key to it for me.
And that's why we don't get to see the women saying or singing these poems in your film. But can you describe that? How are these performed?
Traditionally, Landai, no one's quite sure where they came from. Historically, it seems that one of the most likely origins is that they originated out of the Aryan caravans that came to Afghanistan thousands of years ago. And it could be, since they tend to contain this call and response format, it could be that they were actually ways in which people communicated in a long caravan, traveling nomadic caravan from the back to the front. So that might have been a historical origin of them. They certainly contain language that harkens back to this very old pattern of movement and tents and lovers and hillsides and moons and flowers. Those are the old ones. Then over the thousands of years, the way in which they have primarily been performed is that men and women separately, not together, have traded them really for fun around a fire at night, after, you know, farming all day, at a wedding, because men and women are separated for weddings. So, and they perform them with this little drum called a daira, which is a hand drum. And they're sung, kind of chanted. That's one way. And they typically, the idea of trading them, swapping them, there's a traditional place called the Godar, the watering place, which basically is the riverbank. And what's happening now, which is really fun and interesting, is that some of the Landais make references to the internet as the new riverbank, because the virtual trading and swapping of Landai, especially since so many millions of Pashtun live in exile, has really outpaced the kind of rural tradition of trading them over or around a fire at night.
You make me think of that one, Eliza, that begins, "Slide your hand inside my bra." Do you remember that?
Yeah. That one goes, "Slide your hand inside my bra, stroke a red and ripening pomegranate from Kandahar."
So that's spoken by a girl, right? And obviously, I mean, we get the gist, but how
is spoken by a wickedly feisty girl.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. How might Afghanis hear it differently than we do?
They actually would hear it quite like we do. 100 years ago or so, they wouldn't have heard "slide your hand inside my bra," because there was no such thing as the bra. It's actually bra strap or sandaband, which was hard to translate. But this is hundreds of years old. They would have heard "slide your hand inside my sleeve and stroke a red and ripening pomegranate from Kandahar." So the sexiness, the bawdiness, the outrageous, overt temptation of these is nothing new. It's hundreds of years old. It's just that some of the language has changed to make them much more overt and in your face and very funny for today.
Now, we've been talking about how these poems work for women, but this particular poem is accompanied by one spoken by a boy, and it goes, "I'd slide my hand inside your bra, but who will drop coins in the attendance jar?" What are the coins in the attendance jar referring to?
Well, this is an indication of a new Landai for a lot of reasons. What the boy is saying is he's very smartly getting out of this woman's dare, right? And what he's saying is immensely practical, which is, if I touch you, according to Islam, I need to perform ablutions afterwards. I have to go wash my hands, basically. And the bathroom attendant is going to charge me money, and I'm broke. So are you going to pay me to slide that hand inside your bra? In that way, it reflects a new culture, one in which Islam is more prevalent, in which bathroom attendants exist. And that's just kind of the fun, morphing, remixing, rap way that these Landais function.
And do men also come up with Landais, or is it exclusively for women?
Men come up with them, but most of them, even when men sing them, are in women's voices.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few in men's voices, and Seamus and I were able to attend, thanks to this lover of poetry and a horseman who lives on the edge of Kabul. Seamus and I were able to attend together, which was, of course, a great treat because we had to do so much of this work separately, an evening in which men sat around singing them to one another. And the way that Landai work, traditionally, they would be sort of traded in a competition. Like, you would sing a series of them, and the men sitting around drinking tea would say, "Oh, that's so beautiful. No one can outdo that." And then another singer would take over a series. And again, it's not that the singers made them up. It's that here is my grandfather's Landai. Here is one I heard in the mountains. That's kind of the history of them.
Mm. And, you know, we can hear that these are quite brief, but how strict a form is this?
It's pretty strict. Each Landai is 22 syllables long, with 9 syllables in one line and 13 in the other. They don't rhyme, typically. We worked with a lot of rhyme because it reflects a folk tradition, and it also captured this kind of lilt that landais sound very soft in Pashto, and especially when women utter them. But in fact, the language is so fierce. So that juxtaposition is very interesting and fun when you hear them and work on them to hear what they're saying in English.
Seamus, can we get you to read one or two that you particularly love from this issue?
Sure. Your eyes aren't eyes, they're bees. I can find no cure for their sting.
That's a beautiful little poem, and it's accompanied by an incredible photograph of a woman who's holding up, it looks like she's holding up part of a torn photograph or something. Do you remember that one, Seamus?
Yes, and it's interesting because that was in 2002, and I went back to Kabul literally a year after the fall of Kabul, and this was the National Gallery, which is a small little gallery in the west of Kabul where they had a lot of works of art with women's faces, and the Taliban had gone in and torn things up, and there were bits and pieces left, pictures of Jesus and things they didn't want to see, didn't want to acknowledge. And I found this chest full of torn imagery, and this woman was actually working in the gallery, and I asked just to hold it up to her face. I thought it would make an interesting composition.
That's a great photograph. How about you, Eliza? Do you have any particular favorites?
I like the really naughty ones.
Oh, yeah.
So, because they're so shocking. One that I love is, "Unlucky you who didn't come last night. I took the hardwood bed for a man."
Yeah, that's very shocking. I mean, I remember coming across that the first time. What did you think when you came across that?
I thought, okay, so most of the time I would hear these in Pashto, so which I do not speak, right? And I can read a little bit of it because the characters are the same as Arabic, so I can sound them out, but I have no idea what the words mean. So the best indication that these were going to be shocking is the screeching laughter and cackling surrounding the woman who would repeat this, right?
Yeah.
So I would know something naughty had been said because the women were in hysterics. I love this one especially for a couple of reasons. First of all, it really reminds me of a Pashtun tribal community between Afghanistan and Pakistan in Waziristan and the particular beds they sleep on, which are Pashtun beds. They're called charpai, which means four legs. And once you've seen one of these beds, you understand exactly the allusion. I mean, you can read it in the English, but getting it into the English wasn't so easy because really what it says in Pashto is, "I took the bed for a man." Like, you wouldn't understand unless you'd seen the bed itself and how hard and erect its legs were, what exactly the reference was.
But there's another one there that says, "Is there not one man here brave enough to see how my untouched thighs burn the trousers off me?"
Yes.
That's one of a sequence of several of these poems, right?
Yeah, and it continues. "For God's sake, I'll give you a kiss. Stop shaking my pitcher and wetting my dress."
And so this is by the riverbank, presumably?
Exactly, because it's a woman's job to go gather water. So she would go to this place, the Godar, and her lazy, gun-toting, flower-toting lover would peer at her illegally. Like, men aren't supposed to check out the women at the Godar, but that's what they do. That's where they gather. So the idea is she's getting waylaid on her trip home from gathering the water because this lover has stopped her and is shaking her. The sentiment here is very common, which is this kind of exasperation of Pashtun women at the sentiment and weakness of men.
You touched on this before, but some of the landais in the issue are political, very political. Here's one. "Hamid Karzai came to Kabul to teach our girls to dress in dollars." Maybe you can explain that one for us.
Sure. That is also one of my favorites. Okay, so Hamid Karzai, being the president of Afghanistan, is widely disliked for what's seen as his corruption. And that exists in many different communities and voices in different ways. I mean, here in the West, we're hearing stories of his bags of CIA cash delivery every month. But for Afghans, part of what that corruption means is the impact of this more than a decade now on the culture of women. And so, like really good landai, this one contains several layers of meaning. So the first one is pretty over. Karzai comes with his dollars. Our girls are corrupted by the wearing of dollars. But dollars has a double meaning. in Afghanistan. In Kabul, the tailors who sell clothes sew labels, kind of these Western-friendly labels, into the clothes, which have these ridiculous names like Dollars, Hillary Clinton, Titanic, to make their clothes attractive to these young women. So it's that doubleness that the Landai holds, with really a biting critique of Karzai's presidency.
There's another one that talks about President Karzai that says, Hamid Karzai sent our sons to Iran and made them slaves to heroin. Here's a Landai that reflects the skyrocketing rates of addiction in Afghanistan. Seamus, can you talk a little bit about that? You've really documented this in your work.
Sure. What's interesting actually is how much it's increased in the last, say, 5 years, because I did a story in 2005. I followed quite a lot of the drug story in eastern Afghanistan, and it wasn't really until the production was being done in Afghanistan itself that the real addiction started. Then, of course, you've got people going to Pakistan and Iran, Iran especially. They seem to go to Iran and then be paid very badly, have to work terrible hours. And I think the employers are giving the workers opium and probably heroin as well to get them through the day and, you know, keep them working. I mean, in the time that I was doing the story in 2005, Iran's addiction was extraordinary. Afghanistan was actually lagging quite a bit behind. But it seems that just in the last 7-8 years, it's skyrocketed.
Eliza, you know, the U.S. has been in Afghanistan since 2001, but we're actually scheduled to be out by 2015. As you mentioned in your introduction, some of these Landais that you recorded refer to Americans. Can you read just a couple of those and talk about that?
Sure. First of all, to this issue of the U.S. drawdown of forces, it is so complicated for women in particular because, first of all, you have this rage at occupation, at bomb strikes, at drone strikes, and at the loss of men and children and homes and everything. So you have that. At the same time, you have this, for women in particular, especially women who live in cities. So 8 out of 10 of Afghanistan's more than 20 million women live in the countryside, but the rest live in cities. And for women, urban women, the idea of the U.S. and its partners pulling out means that their jobs, it's more about jobs than security, to be honest, because along with our armies come these massive fat cat salaries from NGOs. Women who were not allowed to work for decades suddenly have jobs, and the men let them go out of the house to get the money because they need the money too. So women have salaries. So the idea that the U.S. will leave both means their security will deteriorate, in part because of the militant presence of groups like the Taliban, who might force them back into home, but also they won't have the opportunities, the economic opportunities they have now. So that's complicated, right? Because you don't want to, you can say, yes, these reflect rage at the U.S., but total U.S. drawdown and abandonment of Afghanistan is not the solution either. So it's hard. And the Landai speak to both sides of that ambivalence. So the first, my lover is fair as an American soldier can be. To him, I look dark as a Talib, so he martyred me. The second, oh, darling, you're American in my eyes. You are guilty. I apologize. Because my love's American, blisters blossom on my heart.
That's interesting. All of them are sort of little cankers, aren't they? They're curled in on themselves.
Little cankers and shankers.
Yeah.
So the one that talks about the American soldier, that one used to talk about British soldiers. That's an old one that dates back to a previous occupation of Afghanistan by an outsider force. And so you have this notion there of lightness and darkness, things that we would recognize, right? These fair foreign soldiers come in. And the joke is, of course, these foreigners have no idea who their own lovers are. And so he killed me, which, of course, is an act of martyrdom. And then in the last one there, because my love's American, blisters blossom on my heart, that too is a far older one. And the line that used to read, because my love's a liar, blisters blossom on my heart. So the duplicitousness of America in particular has been picked up in the poems and in the culture.
Well, there's some about Americans, but there are also Landais about the Taliban. So it's almost like they're kind of caught in the middle, would you say?
This is the community caught in the middle. they have not only lost children and sons in particular to American airstrikes, but they've also lost sons to the Taliban. The Taliban will come into villages and demand that every family give up a son to their cause. So there's deep ambivalence about both the presence of the Taliban and the presence of the Americans in everyday life.
One of these that I loved, Eliza, goes, "My body is fresh as henna leaf, green outside, inside raw meat." That's a very striking, stunning poem to come across, and yet you got it before a wedding, right?
Exactly. That was one of my favorite experiences. I showed up at this home in Jalalabad, in the eastern city of Jalalabad, at night. And as always, when we were doing this reporting, we had no idea. People would say, "Come hear poems X, Y, and Z," and we would just go. So in this case, this was a wedding. It means women. Only women gathered. And what I was trying to see is something called henna night, which predates the actual wedding festivity itself, because a wedding in Afghanistan is a few days long. And the sisters sit around decorating the bride's hands with henna. I basically talk my way into this henna party, and these sweet young girls were there. And finally, we got ushered into the room with the bride. She was on the second floor of this house, which was sort of weird in Afghanistan. There are not that many houses with second stories. She was sitting there caked with makeup, kind of Texas gone crazy. And yet, if you had seen only her hands, it could have been hundreds of years ago, because they were decorated with these henna patterns. And so we were sitting there trading the land eye, this group of girls and women, and the bride. That evening, her husband's family would come, and they would take her from her house, from her father's house, to their house. And so sitting there, I asked her if she knew any Landai about henna, and this is the one she repeated.
Did that express some ambivalence that she had about getting married, or could you tell?
I don't even know if it was that individual, and that's the thing that these Landai are so tricky about, because the collective nature of them and the fact they're anonymous allows a woman to almost disown the sentiment as soon as it's out of her mouth, except that women tend to speak in ones that reflect their lives at the same time. And I'll give an example of that. But yes, yeah, so she was afraid. This would be a woman who is a virgin for sure. And here she is leaving her father's house. But more than typical cold feet or bridal night fear is the reality that when she goes into her husband's house, her official role is to serve her mother-in-law. So she's going from beloved daughter to domestic servant. But there was one other story that I think might be just worth us discussing. And so when Seamus and I started this project, we were in the rural province of Helmand trying to track down the story of what happened to this dead poet. And it took us one day to an agricultural seminar. And in that seminar, we asked if anybody knew Landai. And a toothless young woman stood up, and she said something that made the room explode. And it took some doing to get to the translation afterwards, basically because our translator, who actually later, unrelated, died of a heart condition in the course of the past year, Asma Safi. Asma was 25. She was unmarried, and she didn't know what this meant. But what the woman said essentially was, making love to an old man is like fucking a withered corn stalk blackened by fungus. So that is an outrageous statement. And the only reason she made it is because she'd been married off very young to a man who abused her, and she was actually living with her brother. But in that way, she didn't make that poem up. Her name's Golmakai. But this was the one she seized onto because it reflected her situation most graphically.
Well, maybe we could end with just one more poem from each of you, some favorite Landai that we haven't been able to include. How about you, Seamus?
Yeah, I like, "When sisters sit together, they always praise their brothers. When brothers sit together, they sell their sisters to others."
That's a wonderful poem. I remember, yeah, Eliza sent that to me at the very beginning of your project. I remember getting that in an email and thinking, wow, this is going to be a fantastic issue.
You know, it's sort of playful with the words. It's very clever, but it's also very brutal. I mean, it's what actually happens in Afghanistan.
How about you, Eliza?
Well, one note about them is that, you know, I would go out and collect these things, and my nose would be so far into my notebook that it would be really, I wouldn't even think about evaluating what was good and what wasn't. And I would come back and Seamus and I would have a cup of coffee and sit there and he would be like, that's a good one, right? So it took really that issue of audience. And that one he just said was one of his favorites from the start. And I was like, yeah, that is really good. Here's another one that both of us love. In my dream, I was the president. When I awoke, I was the beggar of the world.
Well, thanks so much, Eliza and Seamus.
Thank you guys so much. And really, thank you, Chris, for making this project possible. It was so much fun.
Absolutely.
You can read all the Landais you heard on this program and many more in the June 2013 issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.